Thanks to Mosoma for sponsoring the first series of The Making Of. Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Mosoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative, and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Mosoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Mosoma.com. You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives. But don't worry, I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest this week is the broadcaster, Emma Barnett.
And I said in my wedding speech, you know, unlike me, I'm like Marmite. And way too many people laughed. And they were people I invited to our wedding.
She's a fearsome political interviewer with her own daily show on BBC Five Live. She's a regular Newsnight presenter and now an author with her first book, Period, About Bloody Time. We talked about a range of subjects from bad manners in the classroom to love, infertility, and of course her very favourite subject, periods. I spoke to Emma over Zoom from her home in London where she lives with her husband and her two-year-old son. So, here we go. Hi Emma, how are you?
Hi.
So we're going to talk today about the six moments chosen by you that have shaped you, brought you to where you are now. The first one that you've given me is changing primary schools.
I was very naughty at primary school, shock horror.
Right.
But there was a parents' evening that was extremely worrying about my capabilities versus what I was actually doing, and that was quite formative. My parents decided to move me, but they lied about the whole thing. They said that, you know, how would I feel if I was moved? I gave a very clear view. I did not wish to be. I was a real tomboy, as with all the boys. It was to be sent to a girls' school. I thought that was completely off. It was a girls' school where you need to take an entrance exam. In the English essay part of that, I was asked how I felt about that school, and I said, I think this is a place that's not for me, and I don't think this is right to educate women apart from men. And I did this whole thing of don't let me in, don't do what my mum and dad want. So I did everything I could to sabotage this move, and it didn't work. I got into the school, and they broke their word and sent me there. So that was quite annoying, to say the least. And I believed I was profoundly depressed. I looked up the word depressed, actually, in the dictionary in our kitchen. I wrote about it in my diary, that was about three sentences long at the time for each entry, you know, right. a seven-year-old using a little cat diary I'd got in a Christmas stocking. And I genuinely believed it was the end of the world. So when you asked me what was the formative moment in your life, yeah. I have to say, obviously, there's many, many recent ones, but that really got me on the straight and narrow.
So do you wonder what might have happened if you hadn't gone there, if you stayed in the old school and you were just a tomboy and naughty?
I do a bit. I think it was one of those, for me, it sounds so dramatic, but it really was. And it is when you're a kid and you leave all your friends behind. And I think that's where I developed a kind of, all right, I'm a bit different then. I'm going off to do this thing called education rather than messing around for 4 years. And I think that's where I started to take what I was good at a bit more seriously. It sounds incredibly grand, but they were all about making you realise your potential. So I think it was a bit of a sliding doors moment for sure. And I remember the first wisecrack I made to one of the teachers, and she thought it was so unfunny. You know, it was the first time someone had sort of said to me, what are you doing?
Oh, really?
It was really like, you don't talk to us like that. So I do believe they made me.
At school, were you... did you fit in, or did you feel like you were maybe a bit different because you were so forthright and confident?
I wasn't like that really at that age. I mean, I I wasn't that confident. I started wearing glasses. I felt really ugly. I didn't understand how I'd ever get a boyfriend. And that certainly didn't look like it was ever going to be possible while I was at a girls' school. That was one of the main reasons that I did not want to go there.
Right.
I was very busy with my ambitions of having a boyfriend. So I did have confidence, but the confidence kind of grew through the academic side of things, not really on the social side. I only really got my confidence back socially, I would say, more and more from the age of 12 when I got contact lenses. Let's not overstress the importance of contact lenses here, but they are important.
So actually, maybe that should have been one of your turning points, like the lens getting.
Can I add it in as a 1A?
As a 1A. Because... So like the first one is you realizing maybe before that you hadn't realized that you had academic talents perhaps until you got your new school. And then the contact lenses made you realize maybe you had talents with the boys.
Yeah, I mean, it's brutal, isn't it, when you look back and you just want somebody to give you a kiss during continuation. Do you remember that game where like someone would kiss you and then you'd have to go and kiss the next person? Do you remember that?
No, I didn't. We didn't have that in London.
You're very old. You're very old. Don't try and pass it off as an northern southern thing.
So the next point you've got is failing. This is number two. Failing grade two piano.
Yes.
What's the story here?
I don't think I'd actually failed anything until that point. And I used it more as a motif for, I didn't think it was possible if you put in the effort, which I had, to fail. And it was a really good lesson. I think what it taught me was that you are just going to fail at some things. And I remember it burned me. Like I was so embarrassed, but no one else knew.
Right.
It was awful. And I remember feeling like, oh, so even if you were, you won't necessarily get it. And that's quite a salutary lesson.
Yeah. And I wonder what that lesson is, though. Is that lesson just like a hard lesson that you just can't be good at everything, even if you try? There are some things that you just can't get.
Yeah. This thing that if you try hard enough, you will get that is not a good thing for us all to live by. Mm. Because there are just some things you're going to be crap at.
So... how are you at failing now? I mean, now that you're, I mean, let's face it, now that you're used to winning quite a lot, you've done pretty well in life. Does failing at things burn even more now?
Well, I've done well at the things that I have practiced at and got into and had a talent for. You know, I was at a newspaper for 7 years. I used to write more than I used to broadcast. And then I changed rounds because I was much more natural at broadcasting. Writing isn't as natural for me. But my point is, I've obviously gone towards things where I think I can do well. That's what people do.
Yeah.
But that said, and you know this because, you know, we've known each other a long time now. Mm. And you've seen me in the sort of state you can get into before doing things that are high profile and high stakes. I do things that are, if you like, within my skill range, but that could go very wrong.
Yeah.
So I do take risks, like the first time I presented Question Time or stood in for Andrew 3 months after giving birth. You know, these are high profile things that if you do mess them up, will not be a good thing for your career.
So you go outside of your comfort zone, but you don't necessarily... go madly out of your comfort zone and try ski jumping, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the physical side of life is definitely not for me.
Okay, well, let's go on to the physical side of life here and talk about meeting your husband. That's number three on your list. Meeting your husband.
Yeah.
Now, why is this a defining moment for you?
Because I met him, well, it would be a defining moment for anyone, of course. I met him when I wasn't expecting it. I was very young. I was 20. I can't quite believe, you know, and now I'm 35, celebrating our 15th anniversary this year. I can't believe I'm one of those people that, you know, like when you meet people and they say, oh yeah, I've been with my husband since uni or wherever. Or like they sound like those weird people who've been together since they were like 16. I'm one of those weird people. I am one of them.
And it's not just about the fact that he was such a lovely man, which he is. But I guess also that he was, did you sense he was someone that was going to support you into becoming the person that you could be, you know, that he was going to be someone who mm-hmm. was respectful of your career and your self-actualization, as it were.
Did you just say that phrase?
Yeah, I did.
Do you need to go outside and vomit?
I'm a bit hot.
You're a bit hot. All right, though. You're so hot today. Going to talk about empowerment in a minute. Self-actualization. Great. I should lie down on this couch. And it's a full sesh.
How did you feel about that?
I always think it's really selfish and really wonderfully selfish. You know, when you read people's messages to each other, if you ever see their anniversary card to each other, if they write something on social media and they're like, I love you so much for letting me be and making me be the best person that I am. And I'm literally like, oh my God, you only love them because of you. Like, you only love them because of what they give you. And I actually love him because I love him. He is... everybody loves him. I said this in our not everybody, but most people love him and have a very good experience when they're with him. And I said in my wedding speech, you know, unlike me, I'm like Marmite, and way too many people laughed, and they were people I invited to our wedding, and everybody agreed with what I'd said. So that again makes it sound like I'm going to say it's about me, in the sense of he makes me look palatable. I remember meeting him sort of thinking, well, you're just one of those people that I actually want to be around and experience life with. And he is, you know, he's a great friend. And I think she's often quoted about her relationship, but Sheryl Sandberg, I think it was her chief operating officer of Facebook, said, because not everybody knows who she is. I'd just clarify that.
That's good.
Is she said, like, one of the best things for your life is to meet that person, because everything else then is okay. And I do have to say that for me is true for me, and it is true for him.
I think that is a very important point, and I don't think that gets enough airtime in the world about how choosing the right person is so important. Catlin Moran actually wrote something really good about this, saying that there was a direct correlation between a woman's success at work and how much her partner is willing to equally share the domestic duties. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I met somebody who was a better feminist than me in many ways, because he'd grown up with a Swedish mother who downed tools when all the boys, she had three boys, he's the middle, when they all got to 18, she said, you know, I'm just not doing it anymore. And they all were cleaning, cooking, they were doing everything. He doesn't even think anything of any of that. And I think he's very natural in what some women and some people have to force. So yes, he's totally on that. And he's a great advocate of things that I'm doing, whether that's sitting in bed at night pretending to be Theresa May as I practice questions before an interview.
That's good.
Through to being a guest when I was trying to get on telly for the first time on my fake news show to send to an editor. I mean, the guy has stepped up in many ways long before we had kids. So, you know, he's also not someone who ever wishes to be on radio or television.
Right.
And yet behind the scenes is very active.
Okay, so point four is hosting the graveyard shift on LBC. Tell me about that.
Well, going back to what we were saying before about taking risks and being a total failure, if you're going to change career, you are going to have to do that. It's clear in the title. So the only way to know if you can present live radio is to do it. Unlike pre-recorded programs like this, which can be edited. But the point is, I remember somebody saying this to me, the only way we know if you're any good is we put you on air. And I was like, what do you mean? Is there not an in-between stage where, you know, you try me out? And they're like, no, because you either fly or die. I was like, oh, okay. So they let me, the bosses at LBC, have a week, 1 till 5. And I remember I was still at the paper, I was still at the Telegraph. So I did both shifts because I couldn't take any holiday at that time. I certainly wouldn't have been able to if I was like, yeah, I'm on holiday, and then in the mornings, if someone had heard, like, the worst thing about going onto the radio is people know where you are,
right?
so that was key.
So, sorry, just going back. So you're working at the Telegraph. You decide, I want to go and start radio. I want to be a broadcaster. Yes. So you
sorry, I haven't explained that.
So you just went and offered yourself to LBC?
No, I mean, it took 2 years to get them to give me the graveyard shift. So I had made a couple of documentaries for Radio 4 about the area that I was reporting on at the time, which was technology. And right. those had gone well. And I then became a regular contributor to broadcasters' programmes on my area of expertise. And I then thought, I really like this and I would really like to try hosting. How does one do that? Mm-hmm. So I began a lobbying campaign of the boss, Richard Park, who some may remember. I think he was on Fame Academy for a few years. And he was like, you know, who are you? And then we got to know each other more. I did more on Nick Ferrari's show on the breakfast program. Nick Ferrari gave me a huge platform to do my thing. We got on really well. And I was finally trusted with the keys. I mean, when I say finally, I got there and it was like me and a sort of 18-year-old bloke and the microphone. And so it wasn't like there was some kind of group waiting for me. And we went on air. And I remember the first sort of 5 minutes of that, like it was yesterday. It's 10 years ago now, I believe, a bit more. And I remember I was so nervous, like I dug my nails into the palm of my hand and drew blood. And I didn't even see the blood for about half an hour because I didn't look at my hand because I thought if I moved my face, I'd go off air.
Right.
Like, I mean, that's how scared I was. But it flew and I was addicted. I was literally on cloud nine when I floated out there at 5 a.m. Yeah, I loved it. It was like breathing.
What was it that you loved about it? What is it?
I remember really clearly that night that there'd been a slut march in London, and I asked if the word slut was something we should reclaim as women, and a female bouncer called me up at 3 a.m. and was like, I'll tell you what I think about sluts, right? I see women so paralytic that they are gonna have something happen to them with a man that they don't want, and I always have to get in the middle of them, and then they'll probably be the first to say there wasn't consent. So there you are, the perfect person, in inverted commas, that you'd always dream of speaking to as a journalist or as a broadcaster, saying the most unpalatable thing about consent, coming off a night shift where she's just had to do that exact thing with a woman for a march had gone had happened in London where people were saying, we want the right to be called a slut. It was like the most incredible sort of guest you could never have booked. Right. There's no way I could ever speak to her unless she was, you know, unless I was on air at that moment, at the moment she was coming home from work. So what I love about it is anyone can call you, but at its heart of it, live radio is properly a two-way street and it's scary.
I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to take a second to tell you about the female lead. In case you don't know, we're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So if you haven't already, please do subscribe. It will really help us to continue our work. Now, back to the show.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit more about your innards. So getting diagnosed with endo, that is your number 5 pivotal moment. That is endometriosis that we're talking about. That's really only just getting the recognition it deserves as a truly appalling condition for so many women, isn't it? That lots of people had to suffer in silence with, and you are one of those people. Can you talk about how you found out about it?
Yeah, just in case people don't know, because horribly still lots of people don't. Endometriosis is where cells that look like the lining of your womb should leave your body like they do during a period, but don't, and stick to other organs and can create terrible lesions, which is and scar tissue, which leads to all the pain. And some women have surgery to try and help with that. I've had the surgery. The problem is there's no cure and they don't know what causes it. So for me, I've got all sorts of problems because of it. So for 10 days of the month, I would say is a write-off for me. I mean, I still work, but I don't do much else. The diagnosis is quite a weird moment for me, because the other weird thing about endometriosis is the only way you can be diagnosed, and I want to like hammer this home, if I may, as a public information message.
Please do.
If you have a laparoscopy, if you have a procedure. All these people I've met before who say, oh yeah, I think I've got that. You don't think, you only know through this one thing, which is an operation and a diagnostic tool. And I think it's really important to know for sure. So I'm not poo-pooing those people who think they may have it, but you don't know until you know. You are either operated on, you have it, you don't have it, and you come back around 5 minutes later. I was out for 2 hours, during which my husband was pacing the corridors. I think the diagnostic moment, you know, I was properly out of it. I was in a hospital bed. I'd never had an anaesthetic before. I'd never been in hospital before. It was quite emotional, because I had to get on board with the fact that I just had a procedure for a disease I didn't know I had. And there you go. So it was quite overwhelming. And also, the first thing I wanted to say to everybody was, I told you so. Even though that's of no use to me, my feelings have changed since then around, I feel really annoyed. I sometimes feel really sorry for myself. I wish that I didn't. I feel it's really unjust when I can't run around with my son in the park. I feel disabled a lot of the time, not all the time. And I'm not using that word lightly. I'm really quite ill. But I hate, because like, especially being a northerner, you know, I never take a sick day. But I have to sometimes. I just have to. And I have had to also learn a new thing again, that being in pain is not a weakness, you know.
Yeah.
And it feels like weakness because of how people can treat you.
And you've written your book, Period, about bloody time, which is about periods. And I guess inspired by your horrendous periods that you've had your whole adult life. In it, you talk a lot about the way that people would respond to periods if men had them. And do you think that's the same with endo? Do you think that if men suffered from this, it would be recognised as a really savage, autoimmune condition, and people would know about it and there would be much more sympathy?
1 in 10 women have it, at least, that we know of. Takes an average of 7 years to be diagnosed. It's not a small disease. It's the same number as people who have type 2 diabetes. And the amount of funding, the difference between that is huge. In terms of research of how, I genuinely believe if men had, never mind endometriosis, if men had periods, there'd be a cure. But with endometriosis, I don't think men would be wandering around like the way that we do, like wounded animals. I just don't think this would be normal. And I certainly don't think we'd have to hide our tampons, or, you know, I think things would be baked into HR policies around this. If men have periods, never mind if they have endo, like, it, you know, it would just be part of our lives.
And was there an anger about your periods that inspired the book?
It was funny. I interviewed Helen Pankhurst for the book about the chapter, which was the chapter I was most surprised by in some ways, that and the period sex chapter, because the thought of me being sexual during my period is such an anathema to me, and the fact that a lot of people are sexual during their period was of huge interest. But the other chapter was, what will I miss about my period when it's gone? And there were people who were saying they missed being in the company of fertile women. There were other people saying it made them feel young. There were other people saying they liked the cycle. They liked the fact they were a bit angry towards the end of it, and then there was this release, and then they were fresh again. You know, all these things I just could not identify with, because their mind does bugger off. You know, there's an absolutely huge party, unless I've then got more pain for other reasons, and then I don't know what I'll do. But the point I'm trying to make is, when I interviewed Helen Pankhurst about periods, who's the great granddaughter of Emmeline, and I met through her campaigning work and through my journalism, she said, there's a righteous anger about this thing that happens to you once a month, and she could not wait for it to go away, to even the score again, that you don't just wander around bleeding once a month, unlike men who never bleed. I mean, yeah, okay, they can have like whatever it is, hemorrhoids, but, and I'm not downplaying.
Oh, and they make such a fuss about it when they do.
I'm not downplaying hemorrhoids. I'm sure they're awful. That's a sentence I didn't know I was going to say today. But you know, when she said that, I was like, okay, cool, because there's quite a lot of, you know, period pride I talk about wanting to have that, but more that you have the right to complain and talk about your period. But there is a movement online to, and it's before online, like it was more hippie-ish, I suppose, to try and embrace your period, embrace your cycle. That none of that can apply to someone who obviously has a disease, because your cycle is your enemy. Yeah. Like literally we're at war. But I just want to say that you don't have to like your period. Like you can just admit it's inconvenient at the very least.
But the
and obviously you can stop it with lots of things, but the other thing just to say is I read this book about the pill and what it's doing to our brain, and I've been on the pill for 15 years and I'm not a real version of myself sometimes. I'm like a chemically castrated version of myself. Men would, you know why we know men would never accept that? Because there is no male pill. Every time they've done a trial on men to try and come up with a male contraceptive pill, the men have complained about headaches, mood swings, feeling hot. Well, anyone who's been on the pill will recognize that little cocktail of side effects, and we put up with it.
It's incredible how much discomfort they do not have to live with or encounter as men. And actually I had this conversation with my husband where he'll have the most minor ailment and I'll say, how can you complain so much about this? And he says, we're just not used to it, give us a break. Like, you guys are used to pain, you're used to having all kinds of different areas on you that are feeling uncomfortable. We're just not used to it. Well, good for them.
You know, the other thing though to say is, and I obviously I'm guilty of this, failing to get my diagnosis. I take it on myself, even though some people say you were failed, but whatever, is that we don't push hard enough sometimes for answers about our own health. And I say to younger women that I meet, you know, women and pain do not have to go together like bread and butter. You should fight to get answers from doctors, not fight doctors, but if you know something's wrong. I knew for years, and that's why when we started trying for a baby, I think we'll probably come on to that, but
well, let's go on to it now.
Go on. What's my next point?
Well, this is, we're in a segue right now. We're on a segue together. So this is point six, number six, having a baby via IVF.
Yes.
Continue.
Massive turning point. I knew when we started trying it wasn't going to go well. So I'm an only child. My parents, struggled, and I'm not going to talk about their experience. That's their sort of private life. But my mum is happy for me to say that. And there was a really horrible moment when I got diagnosed and she heard that one of the side effects of endometriosis is fertility problems for the woman. All the colour drained out of her face as she thought, I've had it and probably wasn't diagnosed. And I could never have another child. And the one that I had was sort of seen as a bit of a miracle kind of thing. And so I remember saying to my husband when we started trying, this isn't going to go well. And he was like, do you know what? Could you want for once be positive about something as we try? And I was like, no, I've got a really bad feeling about this. Like my periods have never been normal. At this point, I didn't know I had a disease.
Right.
And the first thing I said when I came around from the endo op was, have I got it? He said, yeah, you did. And I operated. Can I have a baby? You know, I just wanted to know, because Hilary Mantel came around from that same operation. I knew that they hadn't done this because he would have said it sooner, but they'd taken everything out. They'd taken all of her system out. Lena Dunham recently had a hysterectomy for endo.
Yeah.
So there's a whole thing of, you know, that directly links to that. And the reason IVF, obviously having a baby is a huge thing, but having a baby with IVF, and the way it fitted into my life and the way I thought about things at the time, why it was so transformative. And again, it goes back to that grade two piano exam and failure, is I just didn't want to have IVF. I mean, that sounds so daft, but I held off for as long as possible in a stupid, stubborn way, because I just wanted to do it naturally. My body felt so ill that the thought of them filling it with hormones, I was like, and it was a general election. I was quite busy. I didn't want to have to take a mini fridge round with me, which I did. You know, injecting yourself in Skegness as you search for the leader of UKIP who's hiding from you after you've just interviewed Jeremy Corbyn is a real moment in time, let me tell you.
That is.
But I saw IVF as a failure. Mm. I was like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to be one of those people that has to have IVF, because I've then failed. It's not a comment, by the way. I've obviously changed my view since then and realised how immature and short-sighted it was, but it's not a comment on those people who've had IVF. But that's how I felt, and I held off. Anyway, I met this doctor who said to me, this woman in her 50s, she said, oh, for God's sake, just have it. Just try it. I said, well, okay, I don't want to. And she went, at the very least, you won't have a period for 2 months. Doesn't that sound good? I said, sign me up. Literally, she sold it to me, and I suddenly forgot about all my misgivings.
And then,
so IVF was a humility moment, as opposed to just a moment where I was really hoping to have a child. I never thought it would work. I had zero faith in the doctors, no matter how nice they were to me. Like, literally, when they were putting it in, I was like, yeah, this won't work. Like, saying it out loud to them, they were like, right, could you just be a bit more hopeful? I was like, nice try, guys.
But their fertility problems, I think, are so maddening, because again, like you say, it's something you can't control, but you want so much. Doesn't matter what you do, you can't. And I think it, you know, it drives some people round the bend, like that striving. You want it more than anything and you can't get it. Do you think that parents, you've been on both sides of this now, do you think that parents and non-parents, especially women, need to be kinder to each other? There seems to be a kind of irresolvable wedge a lot of the time. What do you think about that?
I don't think women changing their attitudes towards each other on this. I mean, obviously, yes, if you've been horrible or insensitive to somebody, you know, always on this issue, it's just so raw. Like, the trauma of not being able to get pregnant will never, ever leave me. I regularly speak to women if they feel that they can confide in me, and actually quite a lot of them do, about how to think, how to feel. Ultimately, this is a war in your own head. Like, it's women who've had children can never comfort women who have not or cannot.
That is a powerful statement, and I think there's a lot of truth in it. What do you say to the people that confide in you who are struggling to conceive? I mean, how do you help them?
They're not going to want to talk to you. So I would actually just front that up. It's quite a hard thing to front up. But I would say, I know that you can't really talk to me about this. It's like, listen, I'm not going to patronize. I would say something, I'm not going to patronize you and pretend to know what's going on in your body. I just want you to know that I'm still your friend. You know, and if you want to go out with me and not talk about this and just have a laugh, I would suggest becoming the minister of laughs in your friend's life. I would cheer them up about anything but this. And I would urge those people who can have children, who are friendly with someone who can't, or related to someone who can't, or are struggling at the moment, to be really gracious about the fact that you don't need to talk to them about your kids or your family, to have an entire friendship with them that totally omits that part of your life. You could talk to them about how you feel about your life, but I just think women who have kids can't ever get it, and women who don't have kids can't ever help those people get it, and that's an extra job for them to have to do. The two can't mix.
It is an incredible thing, and I think social media and the way that people post pictures of their children, and then how much that incites so much pain in people who can't have children. Neither side can truly understand each other, like you say.
I don't think this is a really bold thing to say, but I'm going to say it.
Say it.
When I see women, I can't say it.
Say it. I want to hear it. Go on.
It's too extreme, but I'll modify it slightly. I have been saddened to see women who have struggled to have children go on to be the exact people on social media who tormented them the most. I've been aghast, and they know who they are.
Yeah.
And they think, I get it, they think, well, I always wanted this, so by God, I'm going to do it. So you can. But I cannot believe that they do it.
Yeah.
I have posted one photo of me holding my son on social media that was the illustration, not with his face showing, because I don't put him in the public domain, for an article I wrote about how hard maternity leave can be. And I really felt ill after I posted it. But obviously it was about that subject and it was an article. It wasn't, I use social media predominantly for work, and it wasn't about here's my baby. And then I was doing something even worse. I was complaining.
Right. I mean, well, that is a big thing.
But I was trying to bust another taboo for a different group of people that I'd now joined. I'd crossed over that line.
Yeah.
There's a whole other world. I know someone who struggled to get pregnant for years and then did through IVF. And she had a whole other Instagram account about the pain and misery of trying and not being able to get pregnant. She had a whole other persona. She had a whole other life. And I think that is probably the only way you can do it, is that she then got a new Instagram account once she had the baby with all new people and all friends and family that didn't know her through that world. And she divided the two worlds. She's the only person. And even now, her photos of her daughter are not smug.
This next question is often met with a cold response from the interviewee, which is, how do you balance being a mum and working? Because people think that we don't ask men that question, but we should ask men that question, because I think women need to be freed by some honesty on this subject. How do you do it?
I think I'm still learning. Like, I'm only 2 years into it, and obviously I'm only a year and a half into being back at work with the child. I think I've go through phases of it, and I find it, I've learned to try and not do anything work related for about half an hour before I go in to see him, because I find toggling between the two sort of paces and the two types of people one has to be really hard if I go straight in. Obviously a lot of days that's not possible, and you know, during lockdown it's different anyway.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to create boundaries. You know, I've never done that. We all look at our phone, we all check emails. I'm definitely a work in progress, but I don't really know how to do it. I'm just doing it and trying to do well. I have enormous guilt, not about going to work per se, but about the transition points, like when they go off for childcare and how it is, or not just them being upset, because he's no longer actually that upset. He's got better at that. It's more somebody said to me, having a child is a process of having something that you don't let go of for about a year. And then you learn it's a process of letting go again and again and again and letting go of them. So I'm learning to do that.
I think you can't ever get better. I think you can't ever anticipate how much your brain is hijacked once you've had a child. That they are in your thoughts so much of the time, and every decision you make and everything you do, they are a factor in it, like you've never had before.
I also think I feel really guilty when he's not in my thoughts. So I have a really consuming job. Like, for 3 hours in the morning, I'm on the radio. I can't think about anything else other than, oh my gosh, what's the next story? Or who am I talking to? Or what did they just say? And then you come off air and you go, oh, and you sort of got to reground. It's like doing a show, you know, like if you're on the stage or whatever. So I then go, oh my gosh, I haven't thought about him for like 3 hours. But I've got more used to that now, that it's okay for him to have totally exited my brain for a few hours.
And do you think that's different for fathers? I feel like it is a bit. I think they can do that more easily.
So a dad friend of mine, he's just a friend, but he also happens to be a dad. He said to me, he's been doing this a lot longer than me, and he said to me, guilt is such a wasted emotion. Like, I don't bother with it. I was like, oh, like, can you tell me where that switch is on my circuit board here? Because I don't know how to do that. But every time I'm like, be more like him. Be more him. So he doesn't know it, but he's become my guru.
Well, I was once told that guilt doesn't exist, and it's just fear of persecution in the future. It's fear of whoever it is that you feel guilty about at some point being annoyed with you or having a go at you. Something to think about.
Interesting.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I wrestle with that thought of my friend, I will now insert you into that and be like, oh, I'm just scared he'll persecute me when I'm older.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I'm going to give you a final question now. If you have to calm yourself down or think about a happy moment, you know, you go to a happy place, what is that moment that you think of?
I think it's being proposed to. back at university. We went back to university for a talk I was doing, and he came as well. It was very suspicious. He doesn't normally want to come when I go and do a talk. And he proposed on the spot where we met. And I remember actually saying, I'll never be unhappy again. Obviously, that changed because you then go back through life and things happen to you. But I have never felt pure, unadulterated joy like it. So I often go back to that feeling.
That makes me feel quite emotional just thinking about that. Well, Emma Barnett, thank you very much for sharing the moments that made you with us.
Thanks for having me. I hope some of that made sense.
So there we go. That was the making of Emma Barnett. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. This podcast was edited by Lauren Lind, and it was all brought to you by The Female Lead. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you. See you next time.